Power of the Matter is brought to you by Dundalk Baptist Church.
The church meets at the Baptist Centre on RD Terrace each Sunday morning at 11:30 a.m. and Sunday evening at 6 p.m.
And you can visit our website at www.dundalkbaptistchurch.org.
Dundalk Baptist Church provides a free counselling service through Dundalk Christian Counselling Centre. You can contact us in complete confidence on 93 27 094 or email us at christiancounselling@aircom.net.
Well, we hope that you do get in touch with us on any of those ways. You can email the show on Heart of the Matter at dundalkfm.com, or you can catch us on Facebook, Heart of the Matter on Dundalk FM. And of course, we do bring greetings to all those who are listening, not just here in Ireland, but in the United States and on almost every continent. We haven't anybody on Antarctica yet, but that's the next one to come along. But hopefully you're enjoying the show. And if you're listening in India and in Africa, in Europe, and even in the UK and further south in Ireland as well.
Well, Kevin has a question he wants to ask you, but let's set it up a little bit by asking you. So when the flood happens, God has basically destroyed all flesh except for those in the ark. So after that time, the giants, these Nephilim, have obviously died. How do they come back then?
That's probably the number one question I get asked.
Is it the hardest question to answer?
I don't think so, actually. And I've become more convinced of the answer that I'll give you. First of all, you have to realize that they did come back because there were Nephilim in, Numbers chapter 13 at the very end mm-hmm. of that story where the spies go into the land of Canaan. They're actually called Nephilim. So we know that they're there. So then the question is, how do they get there? And there's been several different attempts to answer the question. Some of them are more funny than others. There's some Jewish traditions that there's a giant in the book of Numbers in Deuteronomy. His name is Og. Mm-hmm. And it says that he has it's either a bed or it's a dolmen that is something like 12 feet long or something. And so they took these traditions of Og being very old and even at that time, and they said that he hitched a ride on Noah's ark.
Holding on to the back of it as the flood's coming in.
Yeah, and Noah cut a hole in the top of the ark to let him get some food and stuff. But there's other ideas that maybe one of the lineages on the ark was tainted, and most people will point to somebody like Ham's wife, mm-hmm. and that she carried the genetic material. That one doesn't seem to fly too well with me, just because God seems to be destroying all the flesh that is already tainted, so why would he put somebody on there that is tainted?
Right.
Then you've got the idea that maybe it wasn't a local flood, or it wasn't a worldwide flood, it was a local flood, so some Nephilim from other parts survived. That's, a possibility. I don't really go with that one. I tend to think the flood was universal.
Yeah.
So the other idea, the one I think makes the most sense, is that there was another incursion of angelic rebellion that started to do the same thing after the flood. And perhaps they thought that because God promised he would never destroy the world with a flood again, that they were safe to do what they wanted to do. Mm. And the reason why I think this actually has a biblical possibility is in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, Paul makes a strange statement about women wearing head coverings because of the angels. And the only thing that seems to make sense, and there's actually scholars that have written on this, that he's alluding back to the Genesis 6 story and saying, watch out, you don't want to tempt them.
Yeah, you know, I think you even either talked about that in your book, or maybe I was listening to another interview that you did, and you mentioned that there. But, you know, that probably makes the best sense of any of the interpretations I've heard of that. Because you come to that and you're like, what does that mean, the angels? Why would that even be a consideration?
Exactly. So it doesn't seem to have any purpose other than if this was true.
Yeah, and it fits within that the Genesis 6:4 context so well, I think.
Yeah.
Obviously, talking about this topic, you can't help but think of the recent movie Noah with Ridley Scott and Russell Crowe, and their interpretation of the Nephilim and that. What did you make of their interpretation?
So I have a good friend who's a Hollywood screenwriter. His name is Brian Gadawa. He's a he's actually a Reformed Christian who has written a novel series on this same topic. And he's got seven books on the Nephilim called the Nephilim Chronicles. And he calls what Ridley Scott did there subversion. What the subversion is, it's to take a worldview and to take kind of the story of the worldview, but to pervert it and to twist it into your own image. And that movie did that really well, so that it takes kind of a pagan worldview of earth worship and connects it to the biblical story. And then it disconnects Noah to the biblical God. And then, you know, in terms of the Nephilim, I think what I remember is he had like these rock golems or something like that. They were kind of the comparison of the Nephilim. And that's actually coming from ancient Near Eastern Babylonian literature. And I can't remember. He'd have to remind me. But I don't think that the golems, they're real in their mythology, but I don't think that they're actually technically Nephilim counterparts.
Right. Okay.
So it's just, you know, it's just he's retelling the story to pervert the truth, really, is what he's doing.
Yes. The other thing I wanted to ask you, you mentioned before the break, Doug, about, you know, people and human reasons and explanations for giantism. One of the things, though, with disease and the whole idea of giantism is that people have a disability. They're not able to function well as you know, in terms of physical capabilities. When we think of the Nephilim and think of other mythological giants, we think of physical prowess and being able to do extraordinary things.
Yeah.
So would that be another reason why you would lean towards a more supernatural understanding of their creation rather than a purely naturalistic one?
Yeah, the giants that we get in the ancient literature, like you said, it's not like a really tall, lanky person that is going to, you know, die at the age of 30 and has to walk on crutches by the time he hits 15 or something like that. These are like seem to be well proportioned people that are able to fight. Actually, Julius Caesar, believe it or not, has a chronicles of his Roman wars when he goes up to Gaul, up to France. And he talks about these giant Gaul warriors that are just, he said the Romans couldn't beat them. They couldn't beat them back. And they tried for decades, couldn't beat them back. And he seems to be describing the same kind of things that are going on in the wars with Joshua. And if the migrations that I put in the appendix of the book are anywhere true, and that's actually right where they went to. So
right.
Well, before we go to our next song, I want to ask you, at least, as I was reading the book, there was probably only one sentence that I thought, if somebody was just reading the book, one sentence stuck out to me as this would be a controversial statement. And it's on page 151. And you write, if the giants serve any purpose in the Bible, it is to die by God's omnipotent hand. So can you just maybe flesh that out a little bit? And what do you mean by if they serve any purpose in the Bible, it's to die?
So, okay, this goes back to the story of Genesis 3:15, and if these creatures are what I'm saying that they are, what the Father said that they are, what all the ancients said that they are, these are wicked, wicked beings. You can go to the book of Leviticus and you start reading about all of these things that the inhabitants of the land of Canaan did, and then it usually mentions in a list a group of clans that are in one way or another, either directly or through marriage, related to these giant clans. So these are not holy, holy people in the Bible. They're wicked, wicked beings. Mm-hmm. Their parents are from just horrible. Imagine it, heavenly rebellion of angels lusting after our women, and then relating that back to the serpent in the Garden of Eden. The Bible is not portraying these as beings that should be kept alive. And one of the big questions people have about the Old Testament God is why would he command the utter destruction of all these people in Canaan? Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is that he doesn't do that for many of the nations that Israel comes in contact with, like the Moabites or the Edomites. He basically tells them not to touch them. But when you come to these people, You need to destroy them, because these, not only are they wicked, but this is the battle of the Old Testament between the seeds. It's the battle of basically good versus evil. And so it seems that God keeps them alive just so that he can show that he is omnipotent over the greatest giants, you know, that the world has ever seen. And there's even word plays that go on in Joshua where the mighty men of Israel, that's taking the language of the Gibborim from Genesis 6:4. I think that's in I think that's in Genesis 6:4. They're these mighty men of old. He uses that for the little tiny Jewish fighters who are killing the true Gibborim. So it's it's an ironic thing that's happening there, and God's he's exterminating them.
Well, we're going to go to our next song right now, which is I Surrender All by Ascend of the Hill. And we will be right back after this to talk more with Doug Van Dorn.
Surrender all.
So Doug, I know you have an appendix just on this very question, but I'm going to ask you anyway. You know, throughout the book, you're drawing from several non-canonical texts, First Enoch, Pseudo-Jonathan, but you also draw from stories from different cultures and primarily from the ancient Greeks. So like I said, you have this whole appendix on this issue, but can you just maybe lay out how is it that we should understand, in light of what you've said, the relationship between these mythological stories that we find in ancient Greece and ancient Rome and throughout cultures throughout the world, and then what the Bible says as well? How do we relate these two? Because at the end of the book, you come away realizing that there is some truth behind all of these myths, and that we can't just push it aside as this is just polytheistic nonsense, but it's actually drawing from truth. So how do we make this relationship, or what is the relationship?
Oh boy, we could talk about that one for a long time. That's a great question, Michael. A really important question. I think the way I like to start talking with people about it is that maybe we have a kind of a wrong view of the Bible in relation to other old books. So that sometimes we think that the Bible is the only book that's telling the truth about anything. That's not what the Bible is for, and that's not what we mean when we talk about it being inspired. It's inspired because it tells us the way to salvation and what God requires in terms of obedience to him and what he has done to bring salvation to men. And it's perfectly infallible in what it's telling us to do there. But it also touches on history. And history is objective, and it's outside of Israel, and other people are telling history, and they're seeing the same things. And so we should kind of expect that if it's real, that other people are going to be talking about it as well. Mm-hmm. So you come to some of these other books, and it kind of scares people off because, well, why in the world would I want to read First Enoch? That's got to be an evil book. Well, no. It's just a Jewish book written by perhaps even a believing Jew before the time of Christ. Mm-hmm. And, it's telling the very same story that Jude and Second Peter are telling about this particular topic. And in fact, Jude he alludes to or quotes the book of First Enoch at least a dozen times. And it's not like Jude is a gigantic long tome. I mean, it's like just less than 30 verses long. So he has Enoch all over his mind and is actually quoting from the very parts of Enoch that talk about the giant story. So we shouldn't look at that literature and just slough it off as it's all a bunch of lies. Mm-hmm. You want to be careful with what it says, but the Bible would be our final authority. But basically the Bible is writing the same story that everybody else is writing.
Hmm. So there is, when you're reading these Greek mythologies about Hermes, for example, there's somewhere back behind that story is an element of truth in there. It's just over time it's become distorted and expanded and blown out of proportion, or various things have happened to it. But there is some truth that is behind where it came from.
Yeah, a good way to help people see this as well is when it comes to the flood, for whatever reason, most Christians that support like a worldwide flood idea, they have no problem whatsoever going to the 400 different cultures of the world mm-hmm. that all talk about a flood and saying, look, they talked about a flood. Look, they talked about a flood. And using that to say, see, it's not ridiculous to say the Bible's talking about a flood. Every ancient people had a flood myth. Same thing's going on with the stories of the giants. I have an interesting series of books. I can't remember what the guy's name is. I think his last name is Bunsen. He looks at the Parthenon and he kind of decodes the Parthenon. I have no idea if he's right or not, but what's interesting about it is his take on the Parthenon, which is it's four sided building that's got basically their mythology put into pictures around the whole mm-hmm. thing. And he says he thinks that what they're doing is telling the biblical story, but making the biblical bad guys into the good guys, and the biblical good guys and the bad guys.
Hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah, it really is.
Huh.
Doug, in terms of the overall story of the Christian message and, the message of redemption in terms of God sending his only begotten son into the world to save sinners, How do you see this story fitting into that narrative?
That's really the main question that I kind of wanted to leave the reader with in the book. So many books that are on giants that are out there that you can read, they just go off really the way they want to leave you is kind of in tension of Jesus' second coming and how the Nephilim are coming back and all this kind of stuff. And I wanted to go a very different take with it and kind of leave people with Jesus' first coming. So the Old Testament can be read as a story of the Nephilim and their offspring fighting wars against Israel and God eventually defeating them, but Israel falling short of what they were supposed to do. And the book of Judges is kind of all about that. They refused to kick him out of this place. They refused to kick him out of that place. They refused to kick him out of that place. So judgment comes upon Israel. Jesus is born into this era of just judgment. The people have been returned to their land, but they're without prophet, priest, and king. And when you get to the New Testament, you see this strange language. It's really not repeated anywhere else except in the Gospels, a little bit in Acts and stuff, but of this demonic activity. So where this gets really strange is that, again, this is kind of a universal view of the origin of demons, and you actually find a counterpart to it in Greek thinking. Augustine talks about this in his City of God, that demons are, they were thought to be creatures of the air. Think of like Ephesians 2:1, the prince of the power of the air. And the reason why is because they were children of heavenly fathers and earthly mothers, and they didn't have souls that went either up or down. They just kind of stayed around. Hmm. So actually a demon in the minds of these guys was a lot of people think a demon is a fallen angel. That would not be what they would say. They would say that a demon would be the offspring of the fallen angels and human women. In other words, it's a disembodied Nephilim. So Jesus coming into that kind of a context starts to make a lot of sense of this continuing story that doesn't end in the Old Testament. Jesus is defeating the demons with just a word. He has no problem doing it. Mm-hmm. And he's showing his power over them. And then the cross comes along, he dies. And Paul talks about how if the rulers of this age had known what they were doing, and he's not just talking about Herod and Pontius Pilate, he's talking about the principalities that are behind them, the heavenly beings. And that would also include demonic beings. And you can even think about C.S. Lewis, right, when he has Aslan dying, yeah. And all of the basically the half-breed animals are around that death.
Yeah,
Lewis knows what's going on when he writes that. I mean, he's writing about this very thing. The demons are hoarding around Jesus. The bulls of Bashan, David would call them in Psalm 22. And so Paul says if they would have known what they were doing, they never would have crucified the Lord of glory because it meant their destruction. They had no idea. They thought they were winning, and it's through his death that he ends up defeating them.
Hmm. I don't know if this is along those lines or not, but I'm going to jump from this book to, I'm assuming, what you cover in your book on Galatians. Does the stoichia, does that relate to this in any way? Or what do you say that is? Because usually it's translated something like the elemental powers of the world or something like that.
Yeah, elemental powers. That's a really strange place. It's in Galatians 4. They're called stoichia, and the Greeks had different ideas of what the stoichia were. In our modern anti-supernatural, naturalistic, materialistic context, we just tend to think, well, maybe it's just kind of laws of nature or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there's no question that Paul's talking about some kind of a heavenly spiritual entity. What's really strange about that is after he talks about that, he talks about himself as having been considered by the Galatians. Oh, and by the way, I think I mentioned this earlier, the giants, all the legends are that they went into Galatia. Okay. They would have had this context as he's writing about this. He says that I was so sick that I couldn't be healed. I couldn't heal myself. Well, well, this is such a strange thing to say. Why would he say that? Well, you go to Acts, when he goes into one of the towns in Galatia, it says they thought that he was Hermes. Yeah, and they thought that Apollos, was Apollos who was with him, or Barnabas, maybe yeah. Barnabas. They thought he was Zeus.
Yeah.
And well, Hermes turns out to be the god of healing and of messengers, sending messages and stuff. So Paul's basically saying God wouldn't even let me be healed of this in order just so that you guys realize I'm just a man like you are. So, I mean, the whole thing is just loaded with this supernatural language that is just really fascinating to think through.
Well, we have been talking with Doug Van Dorn, a pastor of Reformed Baptist Church of Northern Colorado and the author of several books, including the one we've been discussing today, Giants, the Sons of God. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure talking to you. And I just want to say again that I really enjoyed the book. And I have on my, I don't have the books, but they are on my to-read list, the Waters of Creation and the Galatians book that you've written. So hopefully after I get those read, if you have the time, come back and we can talk about those ones as well.
I'd love to.
Have we come to the end of the show then, Michael?
We have. It always goes very quickly. So thank you all for joining us. And it just remains for us to say thank you and good night.
Thank you and good night. And we close with a song called Forever Rain by Hillsong.
You are good. You are good. There's nothing good in me. You are love on display for all to see.